and welcome to Pros Before Hoes, the podcast
where we talk about
what we're
thinking,
drinking,
and a reading
for the last time this series.
Maybe ever, if the world ends between now and series three.
Because it would take the world ending for us to ever stop doing this podcast.
Literally, the entire human race would have to be wiped out. But unless that happens,
we'll all be living in bunkers under the ground. But don't worry, we'll find a way to come at you on the airwaves. Like, we'll get you.
The government will be trying to broadcast important information that will save lives of people. And we'll be like, today we're drinking. Speaking of which, what are you drinking today, Al?
Today, I'm drinking some tequila with... I think this is new, Fever Tree Mexican Lime Soda. It's kind of like their take on an easy margarita. It doesn't really taste like that, but it's not bad. And I've just read, made with yuzu juice from Japan. So we're going to Mexico, but we're also going to Japan.
It's a worldwide experience. Pitbull would love it. Mr. Worldwide.
he would love it. It's also low in calories for those that care about stuff like that. It's refreshing.
But it would be nice on like a beach on a hot day.
And it is nice. You want to try a bit?
That is very refreshing.
Yeah. I think if you, like, did the glass properly with, like, the salt and stuff like that and put, like, fresh lime in it, which I just have not done today.
And maybe a bit more tequila?
Yeah, because I had one of those, I can't even remember what brand it was. It was a nice brand, actually.
Yeah.
It was gold tequila, but it was, like, a hotel thing that I just found in one of my suitcases.
So, the best alcohol is the one that you find and is free.
So it was just one of those. With a little bit. Yeah, maybe more tequila. Or there's a few of these in the pantry, so we can experiment.
Are they ours or have we stolen them?
Oh. To the listener, we don't steal. I think the question there was, are they ours or were they left over from when we've hosted?
Potato, potato.
And I'm going to say the answer is yes to both. I hosted a dinner party. There were some left over.
I am drinking a whiskey that my brother got me for my birthday. He bought me a Bullet Bourbon, 10 years, aged 10 years. So it's the slightly fancy stuff. And I'm having it with also Fever Tree. This is not sponsored, but once again, we are open. I'm having it with a Fever Tree ginger ale. And it's very nice. It's very refreshing.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I do rum with ginger ale, but I've never done whiskey with ginger ale.
I don't know if it's a thing, but I've done it and it's happening. And I have to say, I had my second COVID vaccination yesterday. Woo woo. And I haven't had any side effects after either of my jabs. And the only consistent thing is that I drank the same day. So this is not NHS approved medical advice. But I would definitely recommend just getting quite drunk after you've had your jabs both times.
Which one? You've had Pfizer, right?
I've had two Pfizer now.
Yeah. So let's specify to Pfizer, because we don't want people going out getting AstraZeneca, going absolutely wild and then thinking they are going to die.
Yeah, sorry, this incredibly good medical advice only applies to Pfizer.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to? What you been liking?
There's a song I've been enjoying which makes me want to party, and that is a feasible possibility because we all know that from the 19th of July, COVID doesn't exist anymore.
I love that. I like this song. It makes me want to party.
The song Bitch You by Duran Jones and the Indications is really funky and fun and makes me want to dance. It'll get you ready to party post 19th of July.
Oh, yeah. And only then if you're not told to self-isolate.
Listen responsibly.
Every time I go to Inferno's, they'll be like, you've been tapped by the NHS Test and Trace app.
It's just going to be... No, we're talking about things we like. Let's not dwell on.
Let's not dwell. Dislikes are for the end of the podcast. I didn't time this particularly well, but I watched Mae Martin's show Feel Good. I watched all of it in like 2 days. And it was the 2 days where I feel incredibly anxious because it's right before my period. So I cried through the whole thing.
If it makes you feel better. I watched the first season when it first came out last year or the year before. But when I watched the second season, I kind of cried the whole way through, and I'm not really a crier.
It's very emotional, but I really... Mae Martin kind of plays herself a little bit.
Semi-autobiographical.
And she's obviously moved over from Canada. She used to be an addict, and she's met this woman called George at a comedy night, and they embark on a relationship. So Mae's doing stand-up, and she kind of hangs around, and they go on a date, and the show is about their relationship. And there is a scene that, like, I genuinely like cry laughed at. And it's where they're doing, it's like that montage of them having loads of sex where they're just doing role play.
Oh yeah.
And like, it's all like, it, you know, it's not a super raunchy show, but like there's lots of sex scenes in it. And then it just gets to this one where they've been doing all these like kinky role play things. And then all of a sudden they're both dressed in full armor. And they're reenacting a scene from Game of Thrones. And that really got me.
Let's clarify. You were laughing so much you cried. This was not you simultaneously not crying and laughing.
Well, it's really emotive because... Not, sorry.
Chainmail just... Oh, God.
Really, really gets me. No, that was me laughing so hard I cried.
Okay.
But, like, it's a really emotional show. Like, their relationship is very intense. I think it's one of those interesting things as well where, like... I really struggled to tell whether or not they should be together throughout the whole thing. Because normally I come down quite hard on one side or the other when I see like couples in TV shows and stuff. I'm normally like, no, that's like toxic, that's not good. But actually, I think Mae Martin in writing this has really captured this weird like in-between space.
But that's why it's realistic. I get quite fed up with the sort of black and white...
This is Elle saying she gets fed up with me.
No, but, like, humans aren't... Like, the whole narrative around things being healthy, I actually think is quite unhealthy because it makes... Like, people aren't like that. And a lot of things are in the in-between. And that's why I think Feel Good's really good, because it examines, like, the reality of relationships and how they actually function.
I mean, also, and I think, obviously, because Mae's drawing on her own personal experience, really sensitively tackles issues around addiction, gender identity... sexuality. There's another really funny bit where some of George's friends are talking to Mae and they're kind of like, what are you, like a boy or a girl? And she goes, I'm neither. And they're like, okay, well then what are you then? And she's like, I'm an anemic scarecrow. So I think it's quite like it's incredibly, as a TV show, really good at exploring like the in-between and uncertainty. And so yeah, really, really recommend that. Really enjoyed it. Maybe don't watch it if you're feeling very PMS-y. What I hate is that I track my periods on my period app. Because in general, it makes me feel good to understand like why I'm feeling a certain way and to be able to be like, okay, it's because of this. Like I'm still feeling that way, but it's not. I'm not losing my goddamn mind. And also like in terms of tracking pain and all that kind of stuff. But what I don't like is when I've got PMS and I get a sarky little comment from my Clue app being like, you might be feeling a little bit emotional right now, and I'm like, no fucking shit. I just ate a pint of ice cream.
Another thing that I'm liking is that. I'm going to a gig that has been rescheduled. Actually, it might only have been rescheduled twice.
Oh, what gig is this?
The Mystery Jets at Clapham Grand.
Oh, good. Yes. Love the Mystery Jets. Are they the one that do that song with Laura Marling? I love that one song that they do with Laura Marling.
Okay. Young Love.
Young Love. Okay. Yeah.
And I've seen them once before in Briz at Rise Records.
Mm.
And this will be nice.
Will be nice. I'm, speaking of exciting things that are happening, I'm going home. Ooh. My other home, Denmark, the motherland.
Have you lived there?
No. No, but you know, it's more like a spiritual home.
Yeah.
And I am Danish for listeners. So I'm finally going to get to see all my Danish family after like almost 2 years. Well, I say I'm going home. That's provided that I don't get COVID before we go on Sunday. And also that my flight doesn't get cancelled. And, you know, all the mitigating things of, like, in theory, I have a flight booked. Will I make it? Stay tuned. To mix it up a little bit.
Hello.
I requested on the Instagram. I'm pretty sure I told Elle about this. This could be a surprise to her. I asked on our Instagram if we could have some of your dilemmas. So that we could answer.
You did mention this to me, and I had completely forgot.
So surprise.
This is fun.
Yeah. So I've picked three because, you know, we've got to get onto the books eventually, but I thought it'd be fun to engage with you guys and give you our sage life advice.
To be fair, actually, I am really good at giving advice.
She's humble.
Really bad at my own life, but other people's, I'll sort it out.
Yeah.
My own, nah.
I'm both excellent at giving advice and very good at running my own life.
Okay.
So, really, this is, like, gold-tier advice. I haven't really thought about how I'm going to reply to any of these dilemmas, so we'll see.
Yeah, you picked them. You've had prior. Yeah. I'm really going in blind here, so.
The first one reads more like a confession than a dilemma, but I'm assuming they would like help. I'm in love with a coworker who is shagging another coworker.
Right, shagging. So that implies there's not like an emotional thing.
This is
going
to be really interesting because Elle and I are going to take completely different views on.
Yeah, actually, you go first. You go first.
Bin it. Move on. It's not worth it. Don't get involved in that. It's messy. You're young.
Do we know they're young?
Yes. Not really. I'm assuming so.
That feels so classic you. Yes. Oh, actually, on reflection, no idea.
Confidence is key.
Are you in love with a co-worker? Co-worker. Are you in love with them or do you just like fancy them? First point.
That is true and it's a thin line.
Are you saying that they're just shagging another co-worker because that makes it easier for you, or are they like actually like involved?
Okay.
Because that isn't important. If they are literally just seeing each other and you are actually really quite invested in this person and you get on well and there's actually something there,
yeah,
then I don't think there's any harm in you getting to know them more.
Well, yeah, I suppose you could. You know, I just personally, I'm very messy averse, so to me this would be like, I don't want to get involved.
But also, is she friends with the co-worker? There are so many key points of information here that we don't have.
Okay, I think we've got to take it at face value because we can't go back and get that information.
If the co-worker isn't your friend and you get on really well,
yeah,
with this co-worker that you are in love with, which I'm imagining you do because to be in love, then just keep doing what you're doing, I think. And if it's meant to be with the other person, then it won't happen with you. And if it's not, then maybe it will happen with you.
On the flip side, I think you deserve somebody who immediately sees you and wants to shag you, and you should just bin this other person because it sounds messy and complicated and it could end very badly.
If they're seeing someone else, then we don't know how they feel about this person that's in love with them.
Yeah, but they're in a relationship, so you shouldn't...
No, really... they're not. They're shagging.
But they're seeing each other. I just personally wouldn't want to get involved.
But she's in love!
You know,
she's in love.
I've been in love. It ends. You'll find something else.
If it's going to end anyway, then you may as well.
You may as
enjoy
well,
while it lasts.
You may as well ruin another relationship.
It doesn't sound like a relationship. It just sounds like casual sex. In which case, if you're in love, give it a go.
You can take whatever you want from that, really, I feel. The next dilemma that we have is, how do you kick a drunk texting habit? I tend to drunk text people when I'm in a relationship, which is fine. Because it's normally me just being like, hey.
I'm getting the vibe from this, though.
Yeah.
That.
So it's a bit of a tricky one. I would say give your phone to a friend, maybe, when you're out with them.
If you're on a night out, though, that's not sensible. Because what if you get lost?
I mean, you're not a phone person, so.
Yeah, but I am not a nightmare on a night out.
That's true. If you're a nightmare, actually, to be fair, if you have a drunk texting habit, you might be a nightmare on a night out.
I think, really, what we're talking about here is if you have a habit of drunk texting, there's clearly a lot of stuff going on in your head that you're keeping to yourself that you need to get out there in some way. So maybe try and think about those things when you're sober and find a way to, without being super intense, hash those out with the people you need to talk to in sobriety.
Or if it's like a fuckboy that you're texting late at night, you shouldn't be, and you don't really want to be engaged with, but when you're drunk, you want a bit of something. I would just block their number when you go out.
Well, it depends. If you're sleeping with them and you're enjoying it, then...
No, but if you don't want to text them when you're drunk, then that's clearly like a... Yeah, I mean, I guess it's more specific, like, who are you texting? If you have a relationship with somebody, friend or romantic, that's a comfortable, happy relationship, you should be able to drunk text them shit. I do it to my friends all the time. But if it's somebody where... you feel uncomfortable that you're drunk texting them, you don't want to have like a relationship beyond maybe going around to theirs on a night after a night out, or maybe you're not comfortable that you keep ending up in that situation, I would probably just block their number. But I'm quite hard and fast about these things. I think it is very, very dependent, but my advice would be if you feel like you need to say something to somebody and that it's only coming out when you're drunk, have the conversation, like Elle says, when you're sober. If it's somebody that you feel embarrassed when you wake up the next day that you've texted them, maybe just block their number. You can unblock them the next day, but when you're drunk,
yeah,
you're not
just
gonna...
do it for the night. Yeah.
And then the final dilemma is, how do you deal with men who don't read?
Are we talking about all men in our life that don't read?
I feel like this is probably a romantic dilemma.
Okay, like you start seeing someone and you maybe quite like them, but they don't read.
I mean, I work in publishing. I'm a big reader. I've had many lovers. Some of them have read, most of them haven't.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, quite a few of them haven't been big readers. Dated a few bad choices where they just had books on their bookshelf for the aesthetics of it. That's the worst. At least a man who goes, I don't really like reading books. You know what? Fine. Maybe he has other things. As long as somebody has passions and things they're interested about, I don't think they need to match your interests.
But they don't need to, like, read regularly, but I feel like it would be an issue if they were like, I don't like reading.
No, I think, but if they go, look, I fill my time with other things, then I don't think that's an issue. But if for you, if it feels important that they read, if that's like a shared hobby that you feel like you need to have with somebody.
I feel like actually it points to other things.
Yeah.
I don't think necessarily it's that they don't read, but if you don't read as like a, I don't read, it kind of, at least in my mind, makes me think there's a lot of affiliate things that then go on, which I think then build up a picture of someone that might not, if you are an avid reader. Or not even an avid reader. You just enjoy books or think books are important. Because I don't actually read that much.
But I think we all need to make decisions about what qualities are important in somebody that we're in a relationship with. And if this feels important to you, then maybe it's a deal breaker. If it makes you unsettled that somebody doesn't read, perhaps that's a wider sign that you should be taking a step back. But on the other hand, be open. You might fall in love with somebody who doesn't have the same hobbies as you. And that can be a really wonderful thing. So don't, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a warning sign if a guy doesn't read very often. But I think you want somebody who has that curiosity.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So not being an avid reader isn't the same as, like, not reading.
Somebody who scoffs at books.
Exactly.
Prob's not a cool guy. Somebody who's like, I'm just busy and I have other hobbies. Like, I sometimes read, but I don't really.
Don't get around to it.
Yeah. Or you could, if you meet somebody and you think they might be open to reading, why don't you just suggest books for
them?
That
would be so nice. Imagine if two people started seeing each other and one didn't really read, but it just didn't really happen. And then they became a massive lover of books thanks to this person. That would be so nice. So if that's the situation, do that, because it would make us very happy.
I don't know if we've helped, but those were three dilemmas that we've got.
More fool them for thinking we could help.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have advertised that we could help, because
that's why when you told me, I was like agony aunts, us. Yeah.
But I'm only agony. No aunt.
We are the literary aunties.
This week, for judging a book by its cover, I have given Elle a copy of I Who Have Never Known Men by Jacqueline Hartman. What do you think?
It's a cool cover. Shall I describe it or do you want to?
You can describe it. I feel like, describe it with fresh eyes.
So there's a white border, then a sort of, is it like a dark teal?
Yeah, it's like there's like a very, 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 very dark teal that feeds into a lighter teal.
Which is a portrait of a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then over one of her eyes is a pretty big blush, kind of beige circle.
It's like a very pale rose gold circle.
Yeah, over one of her eyes. And then beneath that, it's the title, I Who Have Never Known Men, in white font. It's a cool cover. I really like it, actually.
Mm.
It's quite a hard cover, I think.
It's a hard cover.
To try and come up with, like, a plot or what you think might happen.
Yeah.
But it looks very French to me.
It looks very...
very okay. French to me. And I'm pretty sure that the author writes in French. There's definitely a haunting atmosphere to the cover,
mm-hmm.
in both the colour, actually less in the contrast of colours, but very much with the portrait of the lady. I'm going to hazard a guess that the main character is a woman who has had no real interaction with men, or she has, but it's been traumatic, so she sort of blocked it out. Because But you could really zone in on, like, knowing and all that jazz. But I'll spare you. It strikes me as the kind of book that poses a lot of questions and doesn't give you many answers. Maybe I'm just hypothesizing that because I really like the cover and thus I think I like the book and I like books that do that.
Mm-hmm.
I've not really got much more than that, to be honest. And I think I did all right then.
Yeah, you did do all right. So I'll read the blurb and then I'll talk a little bit about why I love this book. Actually, you've picked up on some themes.
For a very long time, the days went by, each just like the day before. Then I began to think, and everything changed. Deep underground, 39 women live imprisoned in a cage. Watched over by guards, these women have no memory of how they got there, no notion of time, and only vague recollections of their lives before. As the burn of electric light merges day into night and numberless years pass, a young girl, the 40th prisoner, sits alone and outcast in the corner. But soon she will show herself to be the key to the others' escape and survival in the strange world that awaits them above. It's very good.
I mean, this book is absolutely phenomenal. So Jacqueline Hartman is from Belgium.
Oh, okay.
So this book has been translated from Belgish. No, it will obviously be French or German. Could be either. She probably wrote, her name is Jacqueline, she probably writes in French, but she's from Belgium.
Right, okay, gotcha.
It's just phenomenal. This book was actually written in, like, there's been a huge resurgence of kind of women's dystopia, kind of the ilk of Sophie McIntosh, and obviously we've talked a lot about dystopia here, Margaret Atwood, Marge Piercy, like loads of really brilliant female writers.
We love it.
But this has really kind of escaped the main conversation around dystopia, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
No, and I hadn't before my friend kind of handed it to me. And it actually took me a little while, a few attempts to get into it. But once I got into it, I was hooked. And I think I finished it in like a day. It's not very long. It's a slim boy. But yeah, it's kind of somehow escaped the main radar. But it has such a fierce audience of dedicated praise. Now that I've read it, I keep hearing people talking about it.
Ah, one of those.
And it's just been reissued by Vintage. So I think it's getting a kind of second. And rightly so, because it is brilliant. It feels really rare that I can say that I don't think I've ever read a book like this. It's really hard to talk about because, like, not that much happens. But it is all from the perspective of the young girl who's never named. She literally is not given a name. Mm-hmm. There is no point.
Okay.
And they don't know why they're in this prison. There are only male guards.
Are the guards male?
The guards are male. And the story kind of starts off with the narrator's kind of sexual awakening.
Okay.
But obviously she can't do anything. They're mm-hmm. not allowed to, like...
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much mental. Mm-hmm. And, like, her weirdly going through puberty, but she doesn't properly go through puberty because she's been underground for her whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously she's stunted in some ways.
Are they in darkness?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay.
So the lights get turned off at a certain time.
Okay. Like the Love Island villa.
Yeah. It's a bit like the Love Island villa. Yeah, so the closest comparison I could draw is the kind of really quiet violence of Sophie McIntosh's books. So if you've read Sophie McIntosh, I do think you'll enjoy this, but this is...
Was it Sophie McIntosh who did...
The Water Cure and Blue Ticket.
Yeah. Is The Water Cure where they're...
On the island.
Yeah.
The way that... I mean, and McIntosh does this as well, but obviously Hartman did it first. This book was written in 1995. The way that you're just given so little information. But what's interesting here is because the narrator doesn't know anything, that's why you're given so little information. So it's really mm-hmm. organic. It doesn't even feel like a literary device.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're given so little information about the landscape when they're in the prison and when they're out of it, the real terror of it doesn't come from the narrator because she is very strange in the fact that she's completely unbothered. She's really smart, very analytic. Like, she's unfazed. She's not stressed about their situation. That's all she's known.
Mm-hmm.
When they get out, she's very practical. The real terror kind of has to come from your own imagination because you're sort of like, oh my God, why are they there?
Mm, that's really interesting.
And it really just allows you to become entirely enraptured by the mental state of the narrator. She is your guide. And she's honest, open, and she reveals as much as she can, but like the brutal reality, like I said, is that she literally doesn't know anything and you're kind of with her in her ignorance, but she's very dispassionate and unfussy.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked her, but what this book does so well is it raises the really interesting question of what is identity when it's not formed by a world of things?
Mm-hmm.
Because there is nothing.
Yeah.
It's just the woman in this prison.
Mm. Which is actually really interesting because something I find quite stressful and I've sort of made at peace with it is that, like, it's really, and we've definitely spoken about this before, is that how you ever really know yourself because you're just constantly reacting to things.
Yeah.
So you don't know what you like, just without anything else, you don't know who you are.
And I think what's interesting is that she does have a very distinct personality,
mm-hmm.
but it is one that has been formed in the absence of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think that the really, I mean, it raises a lot of interesting philosophical questions, but also how do you build a life of meaning when all the things that we would traditionally associate with meaning, simply they don't have.
Mm.
You're clutching at straws, there's nothing. She doesn't even have a history to have garnered meaning from, because she doesn't remember life outside of that cage.
Are they allowed to talk to each other, though? Do they form relationships?
They're allowed to talk to each other, but quietly.
Okay.
They're not allowed to be emotional.
Okay. I do think, even in that setting, that you would form relationships.
No, so she's quite outcast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is she the only child?
Yeah, yeah, she was the only child.
Right.
Like, they think it was a mistake that she's there, basically.
Okay.
Like, the book is haunting.
Yeah, I got that. On the cover.
But not because of her. She is very calm throughout the whole thing. But it's the way that Hartman kind of lays out the landscape, both in the prison and outside, is just really quietly violent.
Mm.
And it's, like, shocking, but because the narrator is so, like, as far as she knows, this is it. This is what life is for a large portion of
the book. I do find that interesting, though, because he does think that on some level you would find it distressing. That on some core level that is not.
She finds, I think, distressing isn't the right word. She's aware of the horror.
Okay.
But it's, like, such a base, raw, like, reaction to it. It's not.
Okay.
It's not particularly emotional. It's almost like experiencing horror without the emotion. But I think I love this book mainly because of the way that Hartman, like, combs through the mindset of the narrator. So, like, it's just phenomenally written, the way that this narrator, the way she sees things and the thought patterns that she develops and the way that she learns to, like, count seconds mm-hmm. by her own heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, 10 pages where it just goes through how she learns to do that, and it's enrapturing. It's amazing.
And that's really impressive as well, because it's been translated.
Yeah.
So for it to not lose.
Yeah, I don't know who translated it, but, like, credit to them. It's brilliant. Yeah, it's kind of, nothing really happens, but everything happens. In a lot of the ways, it's the absence of everything, of knowledge, of experience, of plot, that forces your mind to read every word like it might reveal something.
This sounds literally like my ideal book.
Yeah. I don't want to give away anything else, because not loads happen, so I feel like if I talk about it anymore, I'll give too much away.
Mm-hmm.
But I, like, cannot recommend this book enough. I think this is my favourite book that I've read in years.
Can I take it to Cornwall?
Yeah, I think so. I've borrowed this from my friend Ellen, so I will ask her.
I'm a very safe pair of hands when it comes to books.
Yeah, and then kind of on the flip side. So, yeah, I'm really ending this season with, like, two of my favourite things, which is female dystopia and love. Either the world is ending or I'm in love. I mean, no wonder I love The Hunger Games, like the perfect combination of the two. I was very lucky to be gifted an advanced copy of Conversations on Love by Natasha Lunn. It's exactly what it says on the tin. So it's kind of pitched as a celebration of love in all its forms. And it's essentially Natasha's own experience of her examining her relationship with love as a concept, and why in her youth she searched for it so violently, why she struggled to, like, hold on to it, her meeting her husband, them going through a miscarriage, the kind of friendships along the way. So it really explores every single aspect of love, like familial love, romantic love,
mm-hmm.
Kind of love between you and your friends. And along the way, she interviews a variety of people, Roxane Gay, Philippa Perry, Alain de Botton. So she, because she has a podcast called Conversations on Love, Natasha, and she will kind of weave these interviews in through her own, and they almost correspond to, like, periods in her life where she was asking certain questions, but it's very universal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really beautiful in its depth and the kind of variety of love that it explores. And I mean, I love so many of the people that she interviews in this book, and their insights are really, I don't want to say profound, because I think it echoed a lot of things that I already feel to be true.
Mm-hmm.
But it was reassuring to know that Alain de Botton agrees with me. no, it was, it articulated a lot of things that I kind of believe about love and about our relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That there is kind of, I mean, so many lessons to be taken from this, but, like, that there's a real difference between needing someone and wanting them, and that we have to nurture our friend, like, our love, our friendships, as much as we nurture our romantic relationships. And one thing that I really took away from this was reframing the way that we see love to understand that even when we're alone, we always have love in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of understanding that, appreciating that. It's a real ode to, like, finding love where you can. And finding love where it
isn't
seeing it.
There's a lot of love in the world.
There is a lot of love in the world.
A lot.
But I think sometimes we get caught up as a society in thinking that romantic love is the only love.
Yeah, and it's so boring.
It's boring, and it's also this idea that being alone is being less. And, you know, it made me reflect a lot on kind of, I mean, I'm in my mid-20s, but just by the way time works out, I've been single for most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite relationships. But I always feel like that time when I was alone was I don't want to say like I was the happiest, but like I almost felt the most at peace because...
Oh, it's carnage bringing other people
it is carnage, and like it's beautiful and it's amazing, but they're like the times in my life when I think of being the most happy are actually the times when I was alone.
But when you're alone, you weren't alone.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a really wonderful section on that, kind of redefining how we view love and where we find it. And I think being in a romantic relationship is such a complex thing that is so easy to mishandle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when people are like, oh, I won't be happy unless I'm with someone for my whole life. One thing that I found interesting in this as well, actually, is a lot of people in this spoke about how they had given up the idea of having one great love. And that instead, they were in their 50s, they'd only ever had relationships that were maybe 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for 25 years. And they were like, that is seen as failure. But it's not.
No.
Because I loved them, and they loved me, and we had a relationship, and maybe it didn't last forever. But I think really reframing how we view romantic relationships as well as the concept of love as a whole.
Or just, like, expanding it.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have to be one thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And it doesn't diminish it. Because, like, it could last 50 years, it could last five, like...
And Natasha's writing on her own story is really beautiful. And she writes really wonderfully about kind of the insecurity of being kind of in her late 20s and being single and being like, okay, but I do want that. Like, I do want my person. And the kind of panic that ensues from that and how that's a really bad way to view it. And how when she actually took a step back and was like, okay, look, I am fine on my own. That was when she started to see the kind of love more clearly, and that was when eventually other people were able to come into her life and kind of stay there. But the kind of the respect that Natasha pays to the sheer complexity of love, like, it feels very comforting. And I'm going to read a couple of sections. I mean, I think this book is very much what it says on the tin.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like really comforting and kind to read. But I think my favourite thing about it is that it really promotes love as action, not as something that just happens to us. And I think that sentiment is incredibly empowering, because often we get into a new relationship, we get swept up and we think, oh my God, like, this is happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
I am powerless against this. But actually, the kind of love that persists is, you know, it's a verb. It's a doing.
Mm-hmm.
To be committed to somebody and to kind of progress past that initial rush of stuff, that takes acts. Like, you need to do things to keep that going
mm-hmm.
every day. So I'm just going to read a couple of things. A couple nuggets of advice, which I thought our readers might like. And maybe we'll help them with their earlier problems.
More than we did.
More than we did. So in an interview with... They're quite long, the interviews as well, which is nice because you really feel like you're getting into it. So this is with Esther Perel. Who is an author. She writes a lot on kind of, she's a couples therapist, and she writes a lot on couples relationships and relationships between couples. And she's very, like, her interview is very tough but compassionate. And at the end of each interview, Natasha asks her interviewee, what do you wish you'd known about love? And this is Esther's reply. What would I say to my younger self? Keep your feet well planted. You know, it's not just about who you find, it's also who you're going to be. Love is not a state of enthusiasm, it's a verb. It implies action, demonstration, ritual, practices, communication, expression. It's the ability to take responsibility of one's own behaviour. Responsibility is freedom. Sometimes it's amazing, this thing called love. One day you just think, I've had it, I'm out of here, I'm so done with you, I can't take another minute of this. The next morning you wake up and you squeeze the person and say, I'm glad I'm waking up with you. It's this bizarre thing, it just comes and goes, and it's really complicated. So invest in it. Learn about relationships, don't just read about everything else. Because you learn how to be in a relationship, it's not a given. I really enjoyed that. And again, that kind of harks back to, I mean, it's a thread that throughout the book is mm-hmm. picked up a lot, but this idea that, yeah, we need to be active in our relationships. And that applies to romantic, family, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
you need to show people that you love them, but in a much more complicated and meaningful way. And then the other bit of advice.
But really, it's not that complicated. Do you just show people that you love them?
But I think sometimes we get so caught up in the feeling that we forget the acts around that feeling.
I think some people do. I think it's we've talked about love languages before, haven't we?
Yeah, no, definitely. But I think as a society, we kind of preach love as this, like, but actually it's messy, it's every day, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So then also in an interview with Justine Picardi, who used to be the editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar. So in her interview, when Natasha asked her what she wished she'd known about love, she said, if I could have given myself, my younger self, a piece of advice, it would be don't confuse love with anxiety or the risk of danger with the thrill of romance. The harmony and the calm that comes with a true love is extremely precious. It took me many years to learn that. Yeah. And I thought that was very sage advice as well. I think sometimes we do get caught up in the thrill of it and like taking a step back and just being like, does this make me happy or is this just exciting?
Mm-hmm.
And those are different things. I mean, I think a lot of this is stuff that people already know, but I always think it's important to remind yourself.
And I guess it's nice having it all consolidated in one.
Yeah, book. And like part of people's stories and like...
Mm.
And then I'm going to finish on a really wonderful sentiment from Susan Quilliam, who is, I think, another couples therapist. And Natasha says, what do you wish you'd known about love? And she says that it is infinitely harder and infinitely more glorious than I'd ever imagined. So yeah, big old sap Camilla. Fucking love this book.
But do you think I'd like it or do you think I'd get annoyed?
I think what's good about this book actually is that you can skip through bits and pick up interviews that you find interesting and you can dip in and out of Natasha's life. I'm always so interested in the way that people view love because it's such a universal concept, but on the other side, it's the most personal thing. And everybody handles it and feels it differently. And I think I've spoken about it before on the podcast, this idea that we all experience love differently, but we'll never understand what it feels like for someone else. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I mean, that's why in relationships, like, communication is so key. But I think it was just a really wonderful, level-headed and compassionate exploration of what love is and what it means to different people. And there's also some interesting stuff on, like, the science of sex. And I think I was telling you the other day about some interesting stuff on that. Like, there's a whole section where this sex psychologist, I think it's Emily Nagoski, she talks about how actually, in a lot of cases, and again, this won't necessarily be universal, like, craving sex with somebody can be a sign in a relationship of insecurity. So craving that, like, instantaneous, like, I must have you now, like, constantly, all the time, can actually be your brain's way of saying you feel like you need to forge a relationship with this person, you feel like you need to strengthen the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, sometimes, like, sex, that's what sex is. It can be a little bit of a bridge builder. But if that's coming up repeatedly and you're feeling like you need to compensate by having sex...
It's like makeup sex.
Like, makeup sex, but all the time. And, like, oh, my God, like, I need to... Like, I don't feel close enough to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And it can actually be a bit of a red flag. And that a lot of... like couples who have been married for like 30 years are like, we're happy, but like, we just don't get the spontaneous need to have sex. Is there something wrong with us? And it's like, no, you just feel very comfortable around each other. And like, that doesn't mean you don't need to schedule the time in, and that makes it sound very unsexy, but actually there is something quite romantic about being like, I'm putting time aside to be intimate with you. And so I think it really, I found that really interesting.
Yeah, that is it.
Because we often think like the best relationships are the one where you just want to rip each other's clothes off all the time. And isn't that such a sign that you're so happy together? But to think about it in a different way and be like, sometimes it's almost better if you're comfortable enough that you don't feel the need to like strengthen that relationship all the time.
But then I guess, like you were saying, you being happy in whatever the love you have with different people is will be different for each person.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So what someone... is completely happy with.
Yeah.
And it might not be healthy, in inverted commas, to, like, across the board. It might be someone's, like, nightmare. But if that's what works for you, that's what works for you.
Yeah, and I think it's about having that... I think on some level that is something that you need to be on the same page with the person you're with about. Like, if for them, if something means security that for you means insecurity, I think that's a fundamental problem. You know, and it will either require a lot of work to communicate or might just not work out. And
I guess that it comes down to trust, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because if you've got that with that discrepancy, then it will, could work.
Yeah.
But if you don't, then it definitely wouldn't.
Yeah. So I felt like I learned a lot about, like, the psychology of love, as well as different takes on how we navigate it. So I think it's definitely, it's a really beautiful book. It
sounds holistic.
It's very holistic and it's very interesting. There's a good mix of like personal experience and like love science. You know, it felt a bit like I was being schooled by like an older sister who, you know, also has like a psychology degree. Yeah, so a little bit of dystopia, a little bit of love.
What more could you want?
What more could you want? Go hand in hand.
Wes Anderson. That's what more you could want.
Oh, we're going to go into it now. She's got her Wes Anderson books out.
I'm actually, but because of the kind of books they are, I don't think I'll actually talk that much.
We'll find out.
So basically, Wes Anderson is up there with my fave directors and always has been. And because of this, people get me Wes Anderson books as gifts. Mm-hmm. So I've got the Wes Anderson collection, Accidentally Wes Anderson, and then The Making of Fantastic Mr. Fox, because Fantastic Mr. Fox is up there with like the creme de la creme of just all films for me.
It's very good.
I'm gonna read a bit from Introduction of the Wes Anderson Collection, which covers all his films up until Moonrise Kingdom, so doesn't involve Isle of Dogs and obviously The French Dispatch, which is just coming out now after COVID delayed it for so long. So yeah, this book basically covers each film from like Darjeeling Limited to Life Aquatic to Ten of Arms, like they're all in there. Talks about the films, has got loads, the photography is just fantastic, and Wes Anderson is interviewed about each film.
Oh, nice.
So it's like really comprehensive, such a good body of work, just all in one place. But I'm going to read you a bit from the introduction, because I think when I first got it and I read it, it really hit on something that I'd never really articulated to myself about why I love Wes Anderson films so much. Mm-hmm. And this is by Michael Chabon. The world is so big, so complicated, so replete with marvels and surprises that it takes years for most people to begin to notice that it is also irretrievably broken. We call this period of research childhood. There follows a program of renewed inquiry, often involuntary, into the nature and effects of mortality, entropy, heartbreak, violence, failure, cowardice, duplicity, cruelty, and grief. The researcher learns their histories and their bitter lessons by heart. Along the way, he or she discovers that the world has been broken for as long as anyone can remember, and struggles to reconcile this fact with the ache of cosmic nostalgia that arises from time to time in the researcher's heart, an intimation of vanished glory, of lost wholeness, a memory of the world unbroken. We call the moment at which this ache first arises adolescence. The feeling haunts people all their lives. And it goes on, and it's a fabulous introduction. Like, really, really good. I could have happily just read the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's beautiful.
We'll try and keep it short and snappy. It goes into how rebuilding the brokenness out of the fragments is to create our own worlds, worlds that sort of represent the vanished whole that they were talking about, and how it can only ever be an approximation and be partial. Mm-hmm. But it's in these gaps and inaccuracies that they are faithful maps of who makes them, and that's like works of art. Because Wes Anderson films really tap into like the big stuff.
Yeah.
That they were all mentioning there. And I just think it is a really good summation of what they're about. Because they are basically just life.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting how each film is its own little world. Mm-hmm. But obviously the aestheticism and the style of Wes Anderson film is, like, iconic.
Yeah.
Hence, Accidentally Wes Anderson. I think it's the contrast between the absolute mess of life, but then the style of the filming. And it's almost like by having the neat lines, you actually provide the space and set the parameters for the absolute, like,
Chaos
and mess of human life and relationships. And just existence in general. And yeah, so each is its own little world, but then there's a sort of world of them all, because he works with a lot of the same actors in all the films, so there's a sort of familiarity and sort of comfort and safety in that as well. So I just think it's really interesting, all the different layers, all the different worlds, how they're all engaging with the same things, but then doing it in their very own way.
Yeah.
I just think he's fantastic. And the character development in each film, this is why I like films where nothing really happens, but I say everything happens. Because if you can see things change within the character, to me, that's so much going on.
Yeah.
And I think Wes Anderson films are fantastic because there's a lot going on in a lot of them.
No, they're busy.
They're busy. Not all, like, Rushmore is a lot quieter. Some of the older ones are a bit quieter. One of the reasons I love Fantastic Mr. Fox so much, and my dad always takes a piss out of me this, because I genuinely think it's one of the best films ever made.
Yeah.
Like, I genuinely do. Yeah. And he's always like, ha 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 ha. And I'm like, no, I do.
Yeah.
Because... yeah, it's stop motion animation, and yeah, it's in inverted commas, a kid's film.
Mm.
But each character really moves, and I think that's really important, especially for films where kids do watch that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really lazy to be like, oh, it's for a kid, so quite 2D. But then that does lead me on to the fact that Isle of Dogs, I was so excited to see because there hadn't been a Wes film in a while, and Isle of Dogs came out. And it's fantastic visually to watch.
Yeah.
But I was a bit upset because I didn't feel like the characters had much development. And I think that's what Wes Anderson films are so good at doing. Yeah. So yeah, then accidentally Wes Anderson.
Bane of my life. So just to give a small bit of background before Elle talks about the actual book, I approached Wally Koval, who runs the... I don't know if I'm allowed... Is this legal? Yeah, this is legal. I approached him to do a book because I love his Instagram, because I've only seen a few Wes Anderson films, but, like, I love the visuals. That's kind of my favourite thing about it, because he had already been approached by another publisher, like, a month earlier. So I didn't get to do the book. Yeah, and, you know, just bane of my life. But anyway, the book is lovely. Congratulations.
It is really...
Enjoy the money, Jane.
It is really...
Yeah, they did a really nice job.
They did
job.
A really good... I think it's Trapeze.
Yeah, so it was another publisher at the same publishing house that I was at the time.
I'll read you the foreword, because it's by Wes, the man, the myth, the legend. But yeah, it's just a really lovely book, so... The photographs in this book were taken by people I have never met, of places and things I have, almost without exception, never seen, but I must say, I intend to. Wally Koval and his collaborators have put together both a very entertaining collection of images and also an especially alluring travel guide, at least in the opinion of this actual Wes Anderson. There must be about 200 locations here, which should keep me busy for several decades, but I plan not to let any of these experiences escape me. Especially the Croatian pancakes stand, page 95. I now understand what it means to be accidentally myself. Thank you. I am still confused what it means to be deliberately me, if that is even what I am, but that is not important. I send my very best wishes and much gratitude to this group for discovering and sharing all these peculiar and fascinating vistas.
Oh, that's
isn't that
nice.
Just lovely?
That I can see the pancake stand. And I get what he means. I too want to go to that pancake stand.
Yeah, it's just a delight of a book. It just makes me happy.
Mm, it is happy,
and I too intend to visit. I was going to say all of them, but let's be real. Actually, no, fuck it. I intend to visit all of them.
It's only 200.
Exactly. I could do that.
If you did one a day, that'd be less than a year.
I think that would be impressive, though, considering that all over the world.
You want a little bit of room, you could probably do it in a year.
That's what I'll do for my retirement. Just go and do accidentally Wes Anderson.
There have been worse retirements.
And then, yeah, then I have The Making of Fantastic Mr. Fox, which, much like the others, but goes into more detail about the stop motion. And it goes sort of, like, into the nitty-gritty of how it was all made, and is a bit nerdy, but...
We love a bit nerdy.
I just love it. It just visually to look at it all. Because like I was saying, I love the films for both the visual and then what's going on.
Yeah.
But these books are really good at sort of encapsulating that, which I think is impressive because
yeah,
I think when there's books on films or directors, things can get lost from the screen to the page. But I think these do a really good service to capturing the films and... the work of Wes.
We love it. Something slightly different.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder what it's like to be accidentally Camilla.
I don't think. I think anyone could be accidentally Camilla.
It's all very intentional, isn't it? How was your drink?
Yeah, it was really nice, actually. And definitely improved by tequila, but then I had a little bit of it just on its own. Also nice and refreshing, so.
And I would also really rate whiskey and ginger ale. I had it with naturally light ginger ale, which I think means it's got less sugar in it. And actually, that was quite nice, because it wasn't too sweet, because obviously bourbon is quite sweet.
The Fever Tree one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good stuff. This episode is not sponsored, but should be sponsored by Fever Tree.
We'll take any sponsorship. We,
we sound so needy, but like...
I am needy. Give me free things.
People send us books.
They do send us
books. So why aren't people sending us booze?
Yeah. Make it make sense.
It's not balanced.
This week, my dislike is that I watched Peter Rabbit 1. Great film.
Oh my gosh. Up there in the canon.
In it. Like, that was why when you were talking about Fantastic Mr. Fox being kids' film, but not being kids' film. That's how I felt about Peter Rabbit. Obviously, it's less...
Yeah, I will
it's say... Lighter. It's lighter.
I will
lighter.
Say that... I'm not going to say that Peter Rabbit is one of the best films ever made in terms of a work of art, but I...
But...
love. I love, 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 love Peter Rabbit film.
I, like, cry laughed through a lot of that film.
It's so funny.
It's lost on children. I'm not sure they deserve it.
No, I think... No, but it's the perfect family film. Because the kids are like, woohoo, everything's running around on the screen. And then the adults are just like, pissing themselves.
Yeah.
Because it's so good.
So my dislike is that I fell in love with that film and then couldn't find anywhere local to watch the second one in the cinema.
Is it not still on at the Picture House?
It's not, I checked.
Because I swear when I walked past the other day, it's still on the...
Simply no. I tried.
That's really rubbish.
And it's disappointing. Anyway, that was my dislike. It's petty. It's Peter Petty. But... You know, I also haven't been to the cinema in so long. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to go watch fucking Peter Rabbit 2 in the cinema. Lo and behold, God hates me. What's your dislike? What have you been hating this week? Other than me and everything I stand for. She's not even denying it.
There is only... I'm not entertaining it. I'm not entertaining it. We're not going to dwell on this because it really did hurt. But just a moment. A moment to mourn the Euros final. We played really well. I'm really proud of the team. But it really... really hurts. So that's it. We're not going to talk any more about it because I don't want to, but
for what it's worth, by the end of the game, even I wanted England to win, and that is saying something.
That is really saying something.
Yeah So... I'm gonna add another dislike, and it's all the racist abuse that, what is it, Saka, Rashford, and who's the other guy, Sancho.
Yeah.
Sancho, that was also not cool, but you know what, maybe it will come home next year. And will I want it to when I have to listen to that fucking song all the time again? Maybe not.
It's a great song.
We'll agree to disagree.
It is just objectively a great song.
It's in the canon. It is in the canon of football songs. Yeah, well, you know, I am sorry that I couldn't make that happen for you.
Camilla the God.
Yeah. So sorry. I was busy doing other things. Drop the ball for 1 second.
Yeah.
And look what happened.
If it was actually down to you and you had done that, we would be over.
She's looking at me very intensely. On that note...
But I know it wasn't down to you.
We're so going to go fine. Away and fall out when Elle finds out that I am, in fact, football god. I'm obviously not, because then Denmark would have been in the final.
You're just obviously not because...
because that's the only reason that I'm obviously not god.
Yes.
Denmark would have been in the final of the Euros.
Exactly.
And they would have won, because if I'm god, why not?
Onto the World Cup.
Well, that's us over and out until season 3, which will be ambiguously...
We'll keep you posted.
We'll keep you posted. I hope you've enjoyed season 2. Thank you for sticking around. If you have, if you've stopped listening, you won't hear this, but...
we miss you, maybe.
We miss you, maybe. I don't know. Play a bit hard to get. Maybe you'll come back. As per usual, drop us any comments, feedback. We love to hear it. Anything you want to see in season 3. And we'll
also
be...
just if you want to say hi.
Yeah, you know? You're lonely.
Or just, you know, just friendly.
Yeah, all that. Yeah, that's cool. Cool, yeah, no doubt. Play it cool, Camilla.
I'm going to go to Cornwall and do a lot of reading.
I'm going to go to Denmark and do a lot of reading.
Over and out.
Over and out.
If you've enjoyed listening to Pros Before Hoes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Otherwise, we'll have no idea.